Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 20, delivered on April 13, 2010. The title of this lecture is The Agency Dilemma.
Today, The Agency Dilemma. The Agency Dilemma involves a problem that persists not just in the world of business, which is where I will use this topic in my next lecture on equity, but it exists in the larger world. And I begin this by first of all asking, how many of you have taken business law already? Most of you have. Unfortunately, you did not take it from me, so you did not have the best. I want to begin this, and part of this you've heard before. I've talked about different parts of this during this course, but I want to go back now and begin by talking about contracts. And you might hear my summary layout for this kind of a lecture deviating in some way from that you would have heard in your business law course. I'll say, well, a contract has four important aspects in order for it to be a contract. It has to have four aspects. And you might say, well, I in my class I heard three or I heard six. In a business law course I once heard 12. Four is the right number. Why? Because I say it is. Okay. By the way, how many were you told about contracts? Four? Okay, four. Good. Then it wasn't as bad as I thought it was, the way you took it. Okay, but let's start with this question for you. Madam, what is necessary for a contract to come into existence? There you go. Thank you. Perfect. Sometimes people beat around the bush. You said an agreement. In fact, that's exactly wrong. Okay, so, well, you can kiss my ass. No, you look, got this look on your face like, how dare you? Actually, a disagreement. Why would you have a contract if there were not some actual or potential for a disagreement? There would be no need for a contract. The predicate to a contract is not an agreement. The first predicate is a disagreement, actual or potential. That's why we would form a contract. That would be why we would find a way to write an agreement or to speak an agreement, to codify an agreement, is if there were a disagreement. If you and I were in agreement all the time, we were genetic twins. You're like, dear God, please, no. We were genetic twins. We were in telecommunication all the time. There would never be a minority report. There would always be just one voice. There's a potential whenever there are two parties. There's a potential for a disagreement. A contract is a codification of the resolution of all actual and potential agreements, disagreements, that would arise as a result of some joint activity. Say what? You don't need to memorize that specifically, but it does sound kind of cool. That the contract, and I said all there, strike that word all. It is a codification. It is a codified statement of the resolution of all actual or potential disagreements pursuant to an activity between or among parties. That does not mean, and in that description, it's not a definition, but in that description of what a contract is, I am pointing out that no contract solves every problem in the universe. It makes no pretense, or it should not, of resolving all of the possible disagreements between two parties. That would make the contract useless, because it would have to cover far too much territory. All it will do is cover the activities and the potential for disagreements within the framework of something that we are going to do together. There are many agreements which are not contracts, but all contracts are agreements. Many agreements do not rise to the level of a contract. We can say in many cases that we have a quasi-contract. It might fail one of the four requirements. We could, in fact, even argue below quasi-contract that it's an agreement, but it still has the potential for litigation. Certainly that's been tried before, too. But a contract is a special codification. Now, there I can break up, I can bifurcate contracts along different dimensions. There are oral versus written. Don't say verbal. Verbal is a bastard term. Verbal is oral or written. Verbal is just words. Now, contracts generally, we would say they are either written or they are oral. Now, let me try this on you. Which is a stronger contract, a written contract or an oral contract?
Written.
You would assume wrong.
Yeah.
Every contract that is written is better than every contract that is oral? In general, no. In fact, the vast majority of contracts that you in which you will engage in your life are oral. They are perfectly fine. They have no defect. They execute properly, close off, and are done, and everyone is more or less happy. Oral contracts are the most common kinds of contracts. In fact, contract goes back so deeply in our language that we can find the root words in the very mother tongue of the languages of virtually the entire Western world. They come from the Proto-Indo-European. Contract is linked to words that have this L sound in them. Link, in fact. Line, ligature, ligament, bindings of people, bindings together for one purpose or another. And you can find those across the languages of the Indo-European group. These words that go back to the voices of our mother tongue, where they understood the necessity of coming into binding agreements. Let us begin. By the way, bifurcating contracts, you can have oral versus written. And there is no fundamental defect in an oral contract. In fact, sometimes an oral contract, at least to one party, is preferable to a written contract. And in fact, in a number of cases, an oral contract is highly preferable to a written contract. Think about it this way. Suppose that every time you went to McDonald's and you went up to McBurger Boy and said, "McBurger Boy, I should McLike a McBurger and a McDrink." And you said, "McOkay, McLet me print out a McContract," and you McSign it. That would make for a highly inefficient transactional environment. It's easier if I go up and I say, "Let me have a burger. Give me a burger," and you charge me all that. You see, see how much more effective the oral contract is there than it would be in general? Okay. Good. Now, contracts, and also there are other ways, oral versus written. Also, unilateral versus bilateral. Unilateral versus bilateral. That's another way that you can break divide contracts. I'll pay you $50 if you'll wash my cat. Okay. Now let's try this one. I'll pay you $50 and you'll wash my cat. Will you focus, woman? And you too. Now, you see how one of those is bilateral, one of them is unilateral. You see the difference? We are both obligated, independent of the other party, in I shall pay you $50 and you shall wash my cat. But you, sir, are not obligated to anything, and I am not obligated to anything. Well, actually, I'm not obligated to anything unless you wash my cat. Then I have to give you $50. Unilateral, one party responsible. Bilateral, both parties are responsible. See, whether I pay you $50 or not, you have to wash that cat. And that cat does not like to be washed. But that's your problem, Sparky. Turns out, though, I canceled the contract because it seems that you had bought some surplus equipment from a golf course, including a giant golf ball washer, and you were using that to wash cats. You know, meow. Truth be told, the cat came out damn clean. Okay, now, and there are other ways to do it, to break up contracts too. But let's start with, let me go on to the four pillars of a contract. Now, this is all predicate to agency, because agency is based upon contract. Let's start. The four pillars of a contract. There has to be an offer and an acceptance. Offer and acceptance. In order for it to be a contract, there has to be an offer. The offer has to be specific. It has to be timely. And a few other things. Offer and offer. Has to be a specific offer. Acceptance. Acceptance. The acceptance has to mirror the offer. The acceptance has to mirror the offer. You cannot give me, well, I accept your offer, but I want to pay a different price, a lower price. No, that's a counteroffer. And then I say, well, I feel, okay. Now, understand that a counteroffer kills an offer. A counteroffer kills an offer. I will sell you my 1978 Ford Pinto. Those were the ones that they exploded when they got bumped from behind. They were really cool on the road. You know, the occasional fireball when a trucker on a little too much amphetamines tapped the bumper. You know, everyone around, you know, cheered. Okay, I shall sell you my Ford Pinto for $1,000. And you say, no. And then I wait around, and you call back. I'll tell you what. I'll buy it from you for $700. Well, you see, I will say no. And you say, fine, I'll take the $1,000 offer that you made. And I say, there is no $1,000 offer. And there is no $1,000 offer for two reasons. One, you said no. And then two, you made a counteroffer. So in either case, you've killed that offer. That, as this one law professor whose lectures are just delightful, he said, the offer is like a cocoon with a beautiful butterfly inside. If you say yes to the cocoon, it opens into a beautiful... The guy was really small. He creeped the hell out of people when he did. But if you say no, you've crushed that son of a bitch. You crushed it twice. You see, you've killed it. So you've made a counteroffer. Okay, I say, no, $1,000. So what have I done? Have I made my offer again? Actually, no. I've made a counteroffer. Okay? Now the price, I say, $1,200. Okay. Offer and acceptance. But remember, the acceptance has to mirror the offer. Otherwise, it's not an acceptance. It's a counteroffer. That's the first one. Now, the second one is mutual consideration. Thing of value for thing of value. Specifically attaching the things of value under the agreement. Mutual. Who do I do for this? Ah. No. This one's a little tough. Now this is, there's nothing, I'm not making any advance, please, but, okay. Okay, we went bowling. I paid for the bowling shoes, paid for the lanes. Now I expect, you know what? I expect you to eat White Castle cheeseburgers with me. Oh yeah, love that bad breath on a woman. You owe me. You owe me a burger night. And if you say no, you violated our contract because you took that bowling. You said, sure, I'll take your bowling night. Truth be told, you beat my ass at the bowling. Did I violate contract? Absolutely not. There was no mutual consideration by understanding. There was no meeting of minds on, I give you a gift. So guys, when you give that ring, that engagement ring to a girl, and she later goes off and marries some stud who's a Johnny Depp lookalike, you got nothing, man, except fail on failblog.org, okay? You see, there's no mutuality of consideration. Oh, I gave you a gift, so I really expect you to do some things for me. That expectation rises to the level of meh. Has to be mutual consideration, thing of value for thing of value. And generally, unless you're talking about promissory estoppel, it has to be relatively close in time. The two the exchange has. Now, there are conditions under which one thing of value can be transferred later. But generally speaking, thing of value has to be moved between the parties, one to the other, and then the other back to the other, relatively quickly, or it is not a linking. The link is lost between them. Now, the next thing is capacity. Now, this is a source of more than a little bit of disagreement because in my time, we were taught very specifically that capacity had very sharp rules. And I can cite court cases, case law, on my side. I have, however, seen recent introductory level legal environment of business textbooks, and I've even had a couple of law students argue this with me, that that is not true, what I'm going to tell you. But I'm going to tell it to you anyway because caution is everything, especially in business. Don't assume that if you're shit-faced drunk, you're out of a contract because you didn't have capacity to enter in. You could very well be held to that contract even if you were stoned. You see. I can cite an interesting case, and this is somewhat anecdotal, but a case that came out of Georgia. Two couples would get together every week, alternating houses, and they would get themselves blattoed on booze and have fun, games, just chat and all that. One night, they were all drunk, and the one guy, he was bitching about his house, and he said to the guy from the other house and his wife, I'd sell you this piece of shit for $1. And the other guy, put it on a napkin. I hereby sell you a house for $1. Signed it. Next day, the guy comes to the house and says, here's your dollar. What? No, I got you. You said you'd sell it to me for $1. You got it in writing right here. No. No, I was drunk. It's on a piece of paper. Come on. One, it was written. There is no rule that a contract has to be on something other than toilet paper. Two, it was bona fide. It was legit. Three, capacity was not considered impaired by being wasted in this case. Okay? Don't assume that you get out of contracts just because you are impaired. So when you go out there into the real world, if you are on some doctor's happy pills, or maybe a neighbor who pretends to be a doctor's happy pills, or you are drunk, don't think that that gets you out of contracts in and of itself. Now, as I said, I have disagreement on this from others, but I can cite case law that says no. Courts are not particularly happy about you saying that a contract is void because you were incapacitated because you'd had too much Jack Daniels. Now, there is a good side to this and there is a bad side to this. In capacity, for example, in the old days, we would have considered that, for example, Down syndrome would have made a person incapable of entering into a marriage contract. We can't have these, as we called them in the dirty language of my day, mongoloids going and marrying mongoloids. Now we're a little bit more humane than that. We grasp, they're perfectly fine. They can. There's no defect in capacity to enter into a marriage contract. Certainly some of the people I know of normal intelligence have entered into marriages that were distinctively defective, more so than anyone with Down syndrome. There are other places where we can talk about capacity. Understand that a minor is special under the law. A contract is voidable at the discretion of the minor unless it is for a necessity. A contract is voidable. So when you talk about capacity, be careful when you enter into contract with minors, because a minor can void a contract. Contracts are voidable at the discretion of a minor unless they are for necessities. There's an interesting case, more than one interesting case. A minor adolescent boy, he was 16 or something like that. He left his father and he had an argument. He left. He entered into a lease agreement to move into a place, and then he had a reconciliation with his father, so he said, I hereby void the contract for this lease. The owner of the apartment complex where he had signed a lease agreement said, no. Technically, you can contract is voidable at the discretion of a minor, but in this case, it was for a necessity, a place to live. Therefore, it is not voidable. And then the attorneys for the man and the son came back with, well, it wasn't a necessity because he always had a place to live here with his father. He just chose to leave. Interesting case. Question is, who won? And I won't tell you that. It's an interesting case. But the reason I won't tell you that is I want you to sweat. When you enter into contracts with minors, and gentlemen, that means lay off hanging around the high schools. You are at risk, okay? Seriously, noobs. Get a life. Hang around the sororities. Okay. Legality. Legality. The contract has to be legal. So, you cannot claim contract, even though it meets all of the other requirements, if it is for a drug deal, for example. If it is for prostitution services where those are not lawful. It is not legal for a number of things to be done. So no matter how legitimate offer and acceptance, mutual consideration, and capacity were, if legality isn't met, contract fails. And keep that in mind, too, because, well, look, contract law, before I go on, contract law, as a matter of fact, I was just talking with a corporate attorney last night, and we were just amazed at how far contract law has lost its bearing in recent years. Have you bought software where you pay for the software, you install it, and then it says you agree to these terms, and if you don't click on the I agree, the software doesn't install? Is that a contract? Really? If the Supreme Court would pull its head out of its ass and start doing more cases and stop being pro-business and everything that it's doing like it is right now, that would fail a contract test right away. And yet you are forced to say, I agree, if you want that software installed that you've already paid for. So that is just crying out for an objective look by the courts, a serious look. And unfortunately, that's not going to happen for years to come, sadly. But anyway, those are the four pillars. But I want to go to the next part. And if you want a fuller discussion of contracts, do stay tuned. Maybe you'll be lucky and you'll have to take another B-Law course and you'll take it from me. But moving on now. Contracts are worthless unless the provisions can be monitored and sanctions enforced. No contract is useful if monitoring and enforcement are defective. Both of those. You have to have provisions within the contract for monitoring performance, and you have to have separate provisions for the enforcement of performance with sanctions generally, or that contract is not good. It is a contract, but what is a contract if you can't watch? And what is a contract if you can watch but you cannot enforce its enforce performance under the contract? It's worthless. As a matter of fact, in a way, it's worse than worthless, because if you know what you're doing, you can screw up a contract. And if I'm not watching you, you can say, hey, I met the contract and I'm bitching about how bad it was. And you say, hey, you had the opportunity under the contract to watch me. You didn't. Oh, wait a minute. This contract didn't even give you state how you were going to watch me or what would happen if I screwed up. You see, that's a contract like that is worse than nothing. Because we don't have a contract and you screw up, I'll just beat the turds out of you. I wouldn't. No, obviously. Yeah, I understand. This is academic talk. High academic talk. Okay. But now, this is where we get down to the agency dilemma. The agency dilemma. And I repeat myself sometimes in these lectures. I say the same thing twice. But we'll do this one again. If I have already done it, I apologize. You are the one, definitely. See those sunglasses sitting on his head? They're the wraparound kind. Those are the kind that you wear wrapped around because you plan to have wind going at 150 miles an hour through your across your face. You don't have time for your glasses to flap. Now, you're driving along a beautiful open road out in the hill, in the flat kind of hills out here. Yeah, right. Flat country of Prairie Land, USA. Beautiful road, beautiful sunny day, nothing on the road for miles except the occasional sticky possum cooking in the sun. You don't have time to stop, even though you did buy a spatula. You got places to go, things to see. You see the sign, 55 miles an hour. Nothing in front of you. What the hell? You say out loud, warp 6. And suddenly, the stream of stars begins to come by you. You're driving like a blind trout. You have no incentive not to. 55? Meh. 55. You're driving along and you see up ahead on your sensors, car on side of road, white and black. Ruh-roh, as Scooby-Doo would say. There's a cop up ahead. Now, what are you going to do? Push that pedal further to the metal? Oh, yeah, right, my ass. You're going to hop on that brake, decelerate back through light speed. The stars come back in front of you. See, he's monitoring. So the only reason you are going to slow down is because he is watching you. But as you approach, you wait, he's outside the car. Oh, he's changing his tire. Sweet. Punch overdrive. Wormhole ahead. And you hear in the back seat, Captain, the warp engines cannot take any more of this. We're going to break up. And you say, what do I do? To me, I'm sitting in the seat beside you, the old gray-haired wise man from the early days of Star Trek First Generation. And then you realize it's not Spock, it's the doctor. And I say, I'm a doctor, Jim, not an auto mechanic. You're going to hit that gas pedal again. You're just going to go light speed. You see, because the enforcement aspect isn't there. That's the whole idea. Monitoring and enforcement are everything. This is the world of the agency dilemma. There is a principle. It is his interest that must be maximized. You as an agent are charged with maximizing the welfare of the principal. That could be the wealth, the well-being, whatever. Now, in this relationship, which is called an agency relationship, where there is a principal whose welfare is to be maximized, and there is an agent who's charged with the duty of maximizing the welfare of the principal, the agent has the incentive to maximize his own welfare instead. That is the agency dilemma. Will he? You have to assume yes. The extent to which the agent will not maximize his own interest depends crucially upon the monitoring and the enforcement provisions of the contract between the principal and the agent. So, if we got down to it, agent principal, the management of a company, the board of directors of a company, are the agents of the shareholders, who are the principals. The doctor is the agent of the patient. The lawyer is the client of the lawyer is the agent of the client. Grr. Let's try this one. How about child-parent relationship? In a child-parent relationship, who's the principal, who's the agent? The parent is the agent. The child isn't the agent. The parent is charged with the duty, of maximizing the welfare of the child. But do you see the incentive for the agent to maximize his or her own welfare instead? In all of those cases, now we're going to distinguish here between duty and fiduciary duty in a moment. But think about this. You are going to be parents someday. Trust me when I tell you this. You see, you come home at the end of a long, hard day at work. You are exhausted. There are your kids. They are the principals. Your job is to maximize their welfare. You're exhausted. You're thinking about, oh, I'm just going to make them some nuke and puke tonight. They're jumping up and down on the couch, tearing up, lighting fires. The boy is on the internet looking at porn. Two of the kids are swinging from the lamps. Now, what you're supposed to do, you know what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to run up. Come on, kids. Come on, sweetie. Come on. It's okay. Let's not do that. Come on. Let's go make a nutritious meal together from scratch, and let's have some games, and then we'll read some books together, and I'll teach you a little bit of calculus and things like that. You know, let's just hug. You know what you're going to do instead? And I speak from experience. You, get off that goddamn couch. Here, take my belt. Beat your ass. Stand in the corner. You will do that, I promise. But you see, I want to maximize my own welfare instead of that of the principal. The management of a company is going to pay itself bonuses out the ass at the expense of dividends and capital reinvestment in the company. The doctor is going to sell you medicines that have no efficacy. The lawyer is going to cut deals with the prosecutors. These things will happen to the extent that monitoring and enforcement provisions are not there. That is the reality of it. I want to point out one type of agency, a relationship, where the rules are different. Black's Law Dictionary explains it, and I will quote that in a minute. But you see, you as the principal are responsible for that agent's performance. That agent is going to extract costs from you. You have to assume that agent will. And it is your job as the principal to ensure that monitoring and enforcement provisions are there and that they are in effect and that you don't slip. That's the principal's job in a normal agency relationship. There is, however, an agency relationship where that cannot happen, where there is a fundamental defect in the principal's ability to effectively monitor and enforce. Think about it. In a doctor-patient relationship, like a surgeon, when you're under anesthetic, you can't monitor and enforce. You can't wake up, what the hell are you doing, man? It was my right leg you were supposed to take off. You can't do that. In a client-lawyer relationship, you are not trained in the law. And in fact, in many cases, you cannot on your own, in the presence of counsel, you can participate, but you cannot play your own lawyer in a lot of cases, unless you're doing pro se action. The child, the principal, doesn't know enough to know the difference. That kid thinks nuke and puke food is good. That kid thinks that the nightly beatings are okay, unless he watches Oprah and then the damn kid starts fussing. No. You see, there are relationships where there's a fundamental defect in the principal's ability to monitor and enforce. If that exists, and notice, by the way, with shareholders, the shareholders, by definition, are separated. Ownership is separated from management. That's what makes a corporation what it is, a separation of management from ownership. The owners sit off here to the side, let the management do the thing. That's why the owners aren't held liable for the debts of the corporation. So, by definition, a shareholder cannot do the detailed, effective monitoring and enforcement that would be required, no matter how many disclosure laws are on the books for the company. In those kinds of relationships, we call those that duty, in those kinds of relationships, fiduciary. Fiduciary duty. Black's Law Dictionary defines this as the highest duty in common law. It cannot be any lower than the highest because the principle, definitionally in fiduciary relationships, cannot monitor and enforce effectively. Let's try a marriage contract. Who's the agent and who's the principal in a marriage contract? Easy, boy. If you say the man is the principal, you will suffer. Who is the agent? Who's the principal in a marriage contract?
The lady is the agent.
Are you implying something, Sparky?
No.
Oh, no. Come on. Who's the agent? Who's the principal in a marriage? Ah, you guys should have had me for business law. The man and the woman are the agents. The marriage is the principal. But you never thought of that, did you? You see, the marriage, the union of the two as a single entity, is the principal. When you get married, there is a person that is the two of you as an active legal unit. And you two are the agents. Your job is to maximize the welfare of the marriage. Your incentives might be otherwise. Your job is to maximize the welfare of the marriage. Well, tell that to Jesse James and to Tiger Woods. The next time you can get them off Craigslist where they're shopping. Oh, that was harsh. But fair. God, those are ugly brought. Oh. You see, the marriage can't monitor and enforce. The marriage is a legal entity, but the marriage can't do anything. Only its agents are in there. So a marriage, your duty under marriage is fiduciary. Your wife bitches at you because you didn't take out the trash. You say, I took you out last week.
Oh.
And that's when the fight started.
This is a seriously messed up class, man.
Look, she has to monitor and enforce covenants that will keep the contract going well. You have to monitor and enforce covenants to keep the contract going well. The marriage itself has no power. This is also, interestingly enough, and I came to understand this long after I was a soldier. People say, well, I took an oath to the flag. Bullshit. I took an oath to the Constitution to defend the Constitution against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. That was my oath. I was an agent of a principle called the Constitution. To quote, well, I don't know whether he actually said it. It was alleged George W. Bush said, actually called the Constitution nothing but a goddamn piece of paper. Unfortunately, he was right. It's nothing unless we, the agents, maximize the welfare of that nation under that Constitution. So when I go into the military, when I go into a battle, I might have sergeants and lieutenants and other idiots yelling and screaming at me, but at the end of the day, they're nothing but agents too. My job is to defend the flag, which represents the Constitution, which represents the ideal of freedom that was given by that Constitution. I fight for no flag. I fight for a Constitution of a republic that is a democracy. You see, that the Constitution can't do anything. So we, the agents, are all responsible for it. Now, the highest duty under the law, you keep that in mind. If you are in a relationship that is fiduciary, you don't need monitoring and enforcement. You do it because it is your highest duty under common law, the law of the tribes, the law of the Germanic peoples, not the effete law of the Romans and Lex Romana and their proxies and the French and all those people. We're talking about ancient tribal Germanic law, common law, recognized back to the beginnings that bindings can sometimes be when one of the parties is not strong enough to protect itself in the agreement. That is fiduciary duty. You remember that. But also remember this. Remember how fiduciary duty is the highest duty you have under the law? Be very careful about entering into more than one fiduciary relationship, because then you have to prioritize. And that means that you are no longer grasping what it really means to be in a fiduciary relationship. I tell the story that I had the fiduciary relationship to those the owners of my corporation when I was running one. I had a fiduciary duty to my family, and it just didn't work. You know what? One day I went home, and my family wasn't there. They had solved the problem of dual fiduciary relationships for me because I was too much of a coward to do it myself. Be careful when you enter into fiduciary relationships. They can bite you in the ass in the end. Now, here are the four costs that can be extracted. Agents can pull four different kinds of costs. The first of those costs is perquisites. Benefits arising from position. An agent can, we call them perks. The executive who has a desk the size of an aircraft carrier's landing deck. The perks that are taken by others in their positions. Extracting value from the principals because the agent can do it and is not being forced not to do it. I was in some not that many years ago. It was just a few years ago. I was with executives of a company. I won't mention what company it was, but it's a company near here. And they were talking. We had dinner together, and they were talking about the travel that they were going to do on the corporate jet and this five-star hotel they were going to stay in and the restaurants that they were going to go to while they were on this trip. And I was unfortunate enough to be the one who pointed out to them, it's a good thing I'm not your comptroller. You see, because Greyhound goes to most major cities, and Motel 6, it's pretty damn good, especially when they got that quarter machine beside the bed. And you want to eat, McDonald's will work, you know? And they just seemed, that's just not how we do it. Every dime they were spending on their first class seats in that first class airplane that was a private jet of the corporation, every dime they were spending on their five-star hotel, every dime they were spending whining and dining and schmoozing and having the big life and the good times at the restaurants, that was shareholder money. That was shareholder money, the principal's money, and they were taking it. That's not called direct theft. That's harsh. But it is, at the end of the day. Needless to say, I wasn't invited to dinner with them again. But it pisses me off, you see, because the shareholders are not allowed to step in. And you'll hear me rage about that on Thursday when I talk about Target stock. A lot of these corporations are playing this nasty little game where there are two classes of stock, the class of the insiders and the class of the common share of the regular shareholders. The insiders have super voting rights so they can keep any fussing of the regular shareholders at bay forever and ever and ever. And that's just not consistent with the principles of a transparent, open, and excuse me for saying it, democratic method of electing the management and directors. The next one is shirking. Shirking. The deliberate avoidance of duty. The deliberate avoidance of duty. The person who hangs around the water fountain is a classic shirker. But there are so many other ways shirking can occur. I know what wonderful story. I actually knew the gentleman. He recently retired. Everyone in the office had the same story. He was obsessed with making sure that his desk was always clear. Well, how was his desk always clear? He made sure someone else had any work he had to do. His subordinates did all the work. That's shirking. Going outside, I've got to take a smoke break, and your cigarette lasts 20 minutes. That's shirking. There was a famous, another one I love is this office of one of the alphabet houses back in the 1980s, one of the managers, one of the account executives. Every morning without fail, he'd come in and then he would disappear into the executive men's toilet where he would be 1 hour, always exactly 1 hour, taking a crap. He'd always go in there with his newspaper. How an hour it took to read a newspaper. Maybe he had a hard time with the comics. But every morning he did it. They said it was just like without fail. It was like clockwork. Every morning he'd come in, make sure everyone saw that he was there, and then he'd go to take his dump. Shirking. And there are so many different ways that shirking can occur. You see actually one of the best... famous cartoons comic is Dilbert. Have you ever seen Dilbert? Wonderful cartoon. The guy who does it, Scott Adams, he used to work for a corporation. They got rid of him because he started Dilbert and they didn't like how on target it was. But he describes many of the things that he shows in there are actual examples of the agency cost of shirking. Hammerhead Bob, the guy who goes from one cubicle to the other all day talking to people. Or the slow motion kind of person. You will see this person. You swear that person is moving in slow motion through the day. And you just want to, you don't know, does it need a battery to jumpstart it or what? People like that, shirking. Now, here's another one. One of the next of the four, direct theft. My best story about direct theft was in the 1980s, there was a fad with frozen yogurt. There were frozen yogurt chains coming up all over the place, TCBY or something like that. This can't be yogurt. And different ones like that. I was in one of these stores one day. I was just sitting there grazing on my yogurt, and this whole line of people all of a sudden came in. And this was in a yuppie community out east, and they lined up. And the kids were, of course, fussy, and the parents were obviously suffering from the opportunity cost of standing there in the line quite a while the two people took their orders and processed them. And then down at the end of the line was a young woman who was actually taking the money. And when people would go up to the line, to the place where they would check out, they might give her a $20 bill, and she would take quite a while, punch, 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 and then finally ring it up, and the drawer would open, and she'd give them, count out the money carefully, count it again in her hand. I saw this. And then I noticed the fourth or fifth person had been in the line long enough to have exact change, counted out in his pockets. So he handed it to her, and she said, she put it right on the front of the cash register and said, "Thank you. Next." Oh, he was just delighted. No wait. Out of there. Next person comes up. A couple of people later, someone pays cash again. Direct, exact change. And she puts it down. Next. But every time she had to actually make change, she hit the drawer. But I noticed that money wasn't going back into the drawer that she was setting up there. She would just slowly, whenever someone she had to make change for, it would just slow. And then I saw the most impressive thing in the world. She leaned up against the counter like this and opened her apron like that. See what she was doing? She was stealing money, but only the exact change. There was no monitoring of what she was doing, so she got by with it. It was a fascinating little trick. Now, I actually consulted for a company. It was a meat packing company, and they had a problem with employees taking meat, stealing it, taking it home with them. You'd have people leaving with extraordinarily large pockets in some cases. The joke was with this one assistant manager, he said, "I swear to God, that woman's gone out, come in every morning looking right, and every night she goes out looking pregnant with a roast or something like that." And so they were talking about setting up a whole security system. Well, it turned out that the security system was going to cost them more to install and to have someone watch than it was to let the employees steal a little bit of food. So in some cases, it's not worth it. Just let them have it as a benefit of an indirect benefit. Now, there's one more cost, agency cost: incompetence. That is an agency cost. Stupid is a cost. You will meet stupid. It is a race of beings. And they are everywhere. Now, in another time when I taught business, I would have, in management courses, I would have had you read at least parts of a book called The Peter Principle by a management guru, Dr. Peter, who made this observation, which sounds like a joke at first, but then you realize it's actually a real principle of management. Managers rise to their level of incompetence. Now, before you dismiss it, that is a hugely important thing. In any company, you are going to see people either on their way to their level of incompetence or having achieved it. Some of them achieving it with gold medal status. If you are good at a job, I'm your boss, I say, you're good. I mean, I'm going to, you know, you do everything in your job really well, I'm going to promote you. Oh, God, you're still doing great. I mean, man, I'm just so impressed with you. We're going to move you up to a junior executive. And then you're no longer doing very well in your job. You won't go any further. You have found your level of incompetence, and you will stay there. So in any job, you look at the people around you. They're on their way, or they have achieved their level of incompetence. And that is an agency cost. Stupid is extraordinarily expensive. Stupid is expensive in small ways when the employees around Mr. Stupid have to explain things to him 40 million times. Stupid is a cost when that stupid causes accidents, inattention to detail, when you consider, well, that's not my job, it's not his job. Stupid is everywhere. Incompetence, the lack of ability to handle the job that is in front of you. And then to find excuses is even more inexcusable. This is one of the criticisms I've had of our government for a long time, is that instead of making public examples and firing and pillorying and disgracing public officials who fail us, in many cases, we just let them keep working, let them keep going. Incompetence is a major source of agency cost. So these four together are the agency costs. They are the means by which the agent extracts value from the principal and thereby fails in the agency relationship. The agency dilemma is the reality that agents will act in their own interest instead of in the interest of their principal. We can think, well, everyone is wonderful, everyone does his or her job just right, but that's not how it really works. And even if you do know people who do their work well for the purpose of benefiting and maximizing the welfare of the principal, remember the first rule of warfare. Never assume your opponent's intentions, only his capabilities. As Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. And when we go back to the beginning of this lecture, I bring up, as I said at the beginning of this lecture, the reality of it is that the agent is trying to maximize his or her own welfare. Don't assume otherwise, because the downside, it can be disastrous. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.